We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jachinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by Jorge Galicia. He has been traveling across the country with the Fund for American Studies, telling his story and really making an argument for freedom, making an argument against socialism. Jorge, thanks so much for joining us. And if you could just start by telling us your story. You were persecuted by the Maduro government for your beliefs, your political beliefs. How did you end up here in the States? And what led you to the moment where you were persecuted by the Maduro government?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It is an incredible honor. And my story, let's say, begins in 2014. That's the year when I became a law student in Venezuela. And in that very same year, I decided to join the student movement of my university, Vente Venezuela, which is a classical liberal political party that advocates for, you know, freedom of economy, small government, freedom of religion, all of these values that make it possible to live in a free and prosperous society, right? Unfortunately, in Venezuela, the Maduro regime does not tolerate very well people that advocate for this kind of values, right? And in the year 2017, that's the year when I got in trouble with police in Venezuela because of my activism. You know, one of my best friends, we were part of the same team in Venezuela. In that year, there were massive demonstrations across the country, and my friend and I and another friends were participating actively every single day in these protests because, of course, we were rooting for some change in Venezuela because, you know, the situation was extremely bad. And because of this, well, this friend of mine was captured by police. The police broke into his house in the middle of the night, without a warrant, without any kind of legality or due process. And at the moment he was being captured, we were texting through our phones, and he said, "Hey, man, there is a group of police officers here. What should I do?" I told him to stay silent, but it wasn't enough, of course, and they took him. And at the moment I realized this was happening, I panicked because I knew that if they were coming after him, that meant that I was the next in line because, as I said, we were part of the same team and we were doing exactly the same things. So if they knew about his location, probably my location was also compromised. So I needed to disappear. I was sent, after that event, I was sent into a religious place. And of course, I cannot reveal to you a lot of information about that because I don't want to compromise the safety of the people. But I was sent there. And I was totally isolated, meaning that I needed to shut down all of my social media accounts, turn off my cell phone completely. It was a life-changing situation for me, for sure. Then, well, thanks God, my friend was released from prison, and this also allowed me to resume a little bit my ordinary life in Venezuela. I stopped the activism for a while the next year, 2018. And because of that, I was able to finish my law degree in Venezuela, and that's how. And after that, I applied to participate in a leadership program here in the United States. I was selected to be part of it, and that's the reason I was able to come here. That's a little bit of my background.
Mm-hmm. And you must have known when you first started getting involved in political activism that it was risky and could lead to some persecution. You must have known that going into it and still deemed that it was worth the risks.
Yeah, absolutely. My whole family, you know, my mom, my grandma, my dad, basically everybody was trying to stop me from going into that because the risk was extremely high for not only for me, but for everybody who was trying to do something against the regime. And at the end, they were right. But, you know, the situation in Venezuela was so bad, and especially my own financial situation. Like, you have no idea, especially in that year, 2014, everything went south for us. That's the year when it became extremely evident for us how the system was collapsing. For example, in my house, we stopped having constantly water supply. Electricity started to fail constantly. Inflation, scarcity of products, big lines to just to get a piece of bread. I mean, our quality of life was decreasing so fast in all of these years, 2014, 2015, 16, all of those years, one after the other, the situation became so horrible for us that I just decided to, you know, this needs to change. And I knew it was evident for me that the reason why our situation was so bad was because of the system, the socialist system that the regime was imposing on us. So again, that's the reason I decided to step in and fight for individual liberty and for the restoration of the republic, because I knew that that was the only way for us as a society to turn the world right and go back to those years of prosperity that Venezuela was used to. But yeah, I knew the risk. I took it anyway, and well, I almost paid the consequences. Thanks God I never went into prison, but still I needed to go into hiding and do a lot of bad things that you don't really expect to do, especially as a young, peaceful guy.
Right. Yeah. Just for activism.
Exactly.
Local activism. So what part of Venezuela are you from, Jorge?
I'm from Caracas, the capital.
Sure. And then, so you must have grown up under Hugo Chavez. Can you talk to us a little bit about the situation as it's sort of changed from the Chavez regime to the Maduro regime? What has life in Venezuela looked like over the course of your lifetime?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I was born in 1995. I got to live on the last 4 years of democracy in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez took power in 1999, and until 2013, that's the only president I knew, and then Maduro. I got to experience, I would say, two stages of Venezuela. You know, in the 2000s until let's say 2012 or something like that, my life was not as chaotic as I first described. You know, my family used to be part of the middle class. We used to go out and have dinner in restaurants every once in a while. My birthday parties when I was a child used to be pretty amazing. I have really good memories. We used to, maybe travel some years. It was a pretty good life. And but then again, in 2014, the collapse became extremely evident to us, and that's when everything we basically became poor. I stopped eating as much as I wanted to eat at some point. In 2016, 17, in these years, I even stopped eating meat because it was either unaffordable or non-existing in the marketplace. So I lost a lot of weight during these years. I mean, the transition from one period of time in my life to the other was brutal. You know, like you don't really, as a middle class, you don't expect to live anything like that anytime soon. However, we did. So I would say that the main difference between Maduro and Hugo Chavez is that Hugo Chavez had high oil prices, so he was able to actually spend more because of this, but he did it in a such irresponsible way. Because all of his socialist doctrine, first of all, they stole a lot of money. And second of all, the money that they didn't steal, they invested it in, social programs of all kinds. They were giving people free washing machines, free houses. You name it. It was like a big party. Everybody was enjoying something, even the middle and the high class. And I am convinced that that's the reason why we never saw a real pushback against Hugo Chavez, because he was really trying to give something to everybody. Everybody was kind of enjoying, but it was really evident that this model was going nowhere. It was not sustainable in the long term. So once Maduro took power, oil prices go down. Every other industry inside Venezuela was bankrupt because Hugo Chavez decided to confiscate all of the productive enterprises inside Venezuela. And that was the perfect receipt for collapse, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that all makes a lot of sense. And what do you know about about daily life in Venezuela since you were able to come here and claim asylum? How has it changed?
I mean, do you mean how is different life here and inside Venezuela? That's
no. So like, what do you know about the situation in Venezuela just since you've been able to leave the country? Does the quality of life continue deteriorating? As you say, is anything getting any better? Does it continue to sort of get worse and worse?
Well, that's another really good question. You know, my mom is still in Venezuela. My grandpa, my grandma, my uncles. I mean, I have a lot of family still there, and that's why I still, even from here, I'm still fighting for freedom for Venezuela. And of course, they tell me everything. Now, since 2019 from here, there has been some changes. And I would say that the main reason of these changes are the U.S. sanctions against the Venezuelan regime that were imposed by the Trump administration. You know, a lot of people say like, hey, we shouldn't pursue sanctions because they hurt regular citizens of the country, but they didn't have any effect on the regime. Now, of course, despite the sanctions, you know, the Maduro regime is still in place in Venezuela. However, I would say that because of these sanctions, the regime was forced to take some economic decisions that actually make a little bit more sense. For example, now you have to keep in mind that you have to remember that Maduro's main goal is to remain in power. And he knew that it was going to be extremely difficult for him to remain in power with all of the collapse that we were suffering in Venezuela. We are still suffering from it. But for example, since 2019, at least from now, he has allowed Venezuelans to basically import any kind of products in a more easier way than it used to be. We don't see a lot of control. We don't see a lot of tariffs. So in that sense, we are seeing now a lot of different products inside Venezuela. He's also not controlling prices as much as he used to do to try to tackle inflation. So that's another thing, because of no lack of price control. We can see again a lot of products in the supermarket now. You know, for example, the use of the U.S. dollar inside Venezuela is typical now. It was forbidden for us in the past, basically. But now, you know, the regime has allowed to use the U.S. dollar for regular citizens to try to tackle the inflationary problem. So in that sense, we could say that we are seeing some minor changes inside the Venezuelan economy. It is not as much as, I mean, I'm not going to say that now the Venezuelan economy is heading towards a new direction. I'm just going to say that at least the situation got a little bit more stabilized. But still, you know, we are seeing thousands of people just walking out of Venezuela and trying to escape to look at the southern border, right? All time you see a lot of news of Venezuelans trying to cross the southern border. They just walk through the entire continent. They walk through Central America and then try to go to come here. If the situation was any real better, we wouldn't be seeing this flow of people trying to come here or any other place in the world. But yeah, I could say that economically they are trying to make a little different decisions, but it is never going to be enough for them to try to restore what they did in over these past 20 years.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And actually, listeners should know, we had to shuffle the date around to do this podcast a couple of times for scheduling complications. But I'm so glad this worked out when it did, because we're talking, Jorge, in the midst of the Summit of the Americas. And Venezuela is in international headlines right now because Juan Guaido was not invited to the Summit of the Americas. And there's a quote in this AP article that I'm going to read, Jorge, from Eric Farnsworth, who's the vice president of the Council of the Americas, who says, "The Summit of the Americas is a clear win for Maduro. He's seen allies take up his cause at the summit while preventing his primary rival, whom Washington recognizes as president, from attending." Now, the Biden White House, Karine Jean-Pierre, just yesterday, that would be on Wednesday, kind of stumbled when asked about the Summit of the Americas and said, you know, "We recognize Juan Guaido as president." And, you know, that was kind of her answer to all of these questions about what was going on. And yet here you have Farnsworth, I think, reasonably making this argument that the summit is a win for Maduro, given the way he's been treated and the way Guaido has been treated. What do you make of all of this, Jorge? Is this a win for Maduro?
Yeah, definitely. I believe not only the summit, but you have to look at how the Biden administration has been behaving, you know, with Maduro. They have been sending delegates. Some of the sanctions have been lifted, even though Maduro has not done anything meaningful to try to restore democracy or the rule of law. Everything, human rights keep being violated inside Venezuela. I believe that Maduro was one of the main winners during the last presidential cycles here in the U.S. because the Trump administration was taking a way different approach. You know, that you could see how the pressure against Maduro was incrementing every single year. Trump himself said at one point that he was considering taking some sort of military action. I don't know if that's correct or not, but if that was true or not. But I mean, you can see that that Venezuela was basically one of the main priorities of the Trump foreign agenda, and I really miss those years. Right now, once I have said that, I also have to say that I no longer trust Juan Guaido to keep being the head of the Venezuelan opposition. Or, I mean, we keep calling him the interim president, and I mean, of course, we're better off recognizing him better than Maduro, I guess. But at the end, he's not the president. And Guaido and all his team had so much support from the Trump administration. And despite all of that support, we didn't see any real change. So I think it is time to start looking for new leadership inside Venezuela. And I believe that as long as the U.S. keep recognizing this guy as the alleged president, which I don't know what effect does it really have, because he doesn't control any portion of the territory because of the military. The military keeps supporting Maduro. And I feel like it's been, what, since 2019 that this happened, and we keep, you know, recognizing him. I believe that it is time for, you know, conform a new leadership inside Venezuela, because I feel like corruption, even inside the opposition, and this is really important, not a lot of people talk enough about this, it plays a big factor, a big role. You know, a lot of people inside Guaido's team, they claim that they are fighting Maduro, but when you actually see what they're doing, they have economic ties with their dictatorship, they do businesses together, they do a lot of different things. So that's when you question, like, hey, are these people really fighting for liberty in Venezuela, or they are playing their role to keep the regime floating? Yeah, that's the thing. That's the only issue I have with Guaido. Now, of course, the Biden administration they didn't invite Guaido, not because of these reasons. That would be something good, right? But he didn't invite him because he didn't want to piss off, to make Maduro mad or something. So he decided just to not invite any of two and keep good relations. I mean, get a good relationship with both of them or something like that. That's not going to work either. So I would love to see the previous agenda coming back. That's why I'm supportive of the Republican Party. The Republican Party, especially the Trump administration, has been the only one to actually pay attention to what's going on in Venezuela, which makes sense because Venezuela is so close to the United States. If you think about it, it only takes like a 2 hours and a half a long flight to go from Miami to Venezuela and vice versa. So.
Oh no, I'm so glad you. Well, yeah, that brings up the issue of Cuba as well, which I have a question for you about it too. And we'll get to that, but completely. And I was going to ask you exactly about Guaido because I know there are mixed takes on him. So that in and of itself was really helpful. Now, what would you say? You mentioned the steps the Trump administration took. What would you say is the best policy that the United States could extend towards Venezuela? What do Venezuelans want to see from the United States? And what do you think, what policy do you think would be the most meaningful? What can the U.S. do?
Well, this is a really tough question for me to answer, but I am convinced at this point that Maduro is not going anywhere without some sort of military action. That's a sad statement for me to say because nobody wants to see, war in your country, especially when you have family there. But at the same time, I am convinced that, we have tried everything. We have gone through elections and they cheat. We have gone through negotiation process the Biden administration is trying to push in Mexico. But we have been through processes like this and none of them have deliver any significant positive result for us. We have gone peacefully to demonstrate against the regime to the streets, millions of Venezuelans. And at the end, all we managed to accomplish is people being incarcerated, people being massacred, killed in the streets by Maduro's thugs and police members. So when you analyze that, we have literally tried everything. The only thing we have not really tried is to try, to organize some sort of military movement against Maduro. And I am convinced that's the only path for us. Now, how can we make this possible? Well, maybe we can establish some military funded by, conformed by Venezuelan people living abroad. I know a lot of people who actually were members of the military, who would be more than happy to join some sort of liberation movement and maybe establish it in Colombia or somewhere else. I don't know, but that's the only path I actually see to try to recover Venezuela as a whole. Right. What was the other thing?
No, that covered it. I mean, actually, I'll ask you even more specifically about sanctions. My colleague, John Daniel Davidson, and I were in northern Mexico this week, and a Cuban asylum seeker approached us at a shelter and started telling us his story. And actually, unprompted by us, he said, the sanctions on Cuba are the only way to end the regime. They're the only way to bring freedom to Cuba. And that's obviously hotly contested. A lot of people on the left clearly don't agree with that, but it also applies to Venezuela. And it's in the news right now again as gas prices are surging. I think they're set to hit a new record as of today, Thursday, when we're recording this. And so the Biden administration is in negotiations with the Maduro government, not Guaido. The sanctions seem to be on the table. What do you make of that question, Jorge?
Well, I mean, in the case of Cuba, for example, I think it is pretty obviously that sanctions are not going to deliver any regime change. However, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for some kind of release of sanctions against Cuba nor Venezuela. But what I would say is I believe that sanctions against Cuba and Venezuela are important. Maybe they are important. Maybe they are not going to deliver regime change. But people need to understand that these regimes are expansionist regimes. They are always trying to tackle other countries. They have presence in Colombia. They have presence in Brazil. In all of the region is basically danger because of the influence of all of these regimes. And at least I am convinced that these sanctions, they are not going to deliver regime change. I believe that's pretty obvious by now. But at least they are going to limit their capacity to try to influence in other countries because they keep their finances in really limited. And that's why Maduro has been pushing so hard for the U.S. to lift their sanctions. He has a lot of ties with, you can see all of these socialist groups here in the U.S. You can see how they coordinate with the Maduro regime and they do this kind of fake demonstrations to, demand the lift of sanctions against Venezuela. And because a lot of people believe that sanctions are the reason why Venezuela collapsed. This cannot be further from the truth. Actually, as I said previously, because of sanctions, we are seeing right now a little bit of economic relief. Not a lot, but at least we're seeing Venezuela heading into a little different direction, right? So if anything, sanctions has helped the ordinary Venezuelan. I'm not going to say the same about Cuba, because of course Cuba has been following the very same model even after sanctions. But at least in Venezuela, we saw how things are improving a little bit because these sanctions forced the Maduro regime to take some different approach and are forcing him to stay back from all of this Marxist orthodoxy that he was following before. So I'm convinced that sanctions should remain in place, but I'm not gonna say to you that that's going to be enough to deliver the regime change. I'm convinced that we need to go further than sanctions. We need to do more pressure.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. Now, you've been traveling college campuses with TFAS, and I'm really curious about that experience. I'm sure you get the question all the time from college students, or the argument all the time from college students who say, well, it's not real socialism. What Maduro is doing and what Chavez was doing was, it wasn't real socialism. You're, you know, attacking a straw man, basically. Tell us about your experience touring college campuses with this message. And, you know, what kind of questions, what kind of arguments you get from students on campuses?
Yeah, my experience with TIFAS has been beautiful, to be honest. I feel like this is a perfect way for me to contribute with this debate inside the U.S. And this is a way for me to say thank you to the U.S. society for welcoming me here. You know, I love the U.S. already, and I see how, you know, all of the opportunities that I have seen ever since I arrived to the States. Like, I don't want to lose this, you know, not again. So when I see people, especially young people, advocating for socialism, and I have the chance to speak to them as a victim of socialism, you know, I feel like this creates an opportunity to at least give them a different perspective, right? And that's how I describe this this experience. You know, even in a lot of these events, even when people that don't agree with my ideas and they hear me speaking, they, you know, they aren't there, don't go like ballistic on me, and they try to attack me, you know, all at once because they disagree. But when they hear my experience, when they hear everything I've been through in the last decade, I believe that they, at least they respect that situation, right? And however, I have also seen some pushback from, you know, for example, in University of North Texas, there was a group of leftist students that tried to, they were, you know, vandalizing all of the flyers for the event that we were having there. At the day of the event, they met like outside the venue, and they were laughing and pointing fingers at the people who were walking towards the event. But at the end, none of these people really entered. Like, they didn't hear what the message had to say. So, you know, there was no way for me to try to convince them or to try to give them that different perspective, right? However, in these campuses, a lot of people, you know, they bring the point of, they talk about the fact that, yeah, we are not trying to, you know, Venezuela isn't real socialism. What we really want is, you know, the Norwegian example or the Sweden example or whatever, right? These kind of examples that these leftist people really like to bring out. But you have to, I mean, the reality is that these examples that they use are not real examples of socialism, because in these countries, you know, that you have free market institutions. Sometimes in these countries, you even have a freer market than the one we have right now here in the U.S. That's a fact. They respect private property there. They're not going to be, the government is not confiscating enterprises here and there to redistribute wealth. That's not what we see in this country. And that's exactly what we saw in places like Venezuela, like Cuba. So when you read that socialist doctrine, what Marx and Engels were writing, I believe that Venezuela and the Soviet Union and Cuba represent a way better example to their proposals, right? And well, we already know how that ended, right? So, yes, that's what I usually say, like, hey, Sweden and all of these countries are not real example of socialism. If anything, they are a successful example of capitalism. And you might also, you could make the point that they have big welfare state, but that's another discussion. They are way smaller population than the one we have here in the United States. And maybe their model cannot be replicated perfectly here in the United States because of how big the population is, and et cetera. But that's a different discussion, right? The fact is that it remains the same. Those are not socialist countries. Real socialist countries are, you know, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, China, et cetera.
So, Jorge, the American left is convinced that the United States is a terrible place for non-white individuals, for migrants seeking asylum. That's, you know, just the experience of non-white Americans is soaked in racism on a daily basis, and it's miserable. As somebody who's sort of come to the United States recently, has that been your experience, or is that sort of a totally inaccurate picture of what it's like in America?
Yeah, I mean, if that's really the case, then why are we seeing thousands of people just trying to cross the border every single day just to try to establish here legally? Or I don't know. I mean, why are we seeing that people even willing to break the law just to live here? Right? If the United States is so horrible, why are they even trying to come here? Like, no, I don't believe that's the case. I mean, I you know, my experience as a migrant here has been beautiful. You know, as I said, I have only been here a little bit more than 3 years. And in that short period of time, I have already seen like the triple or more of the opportunities that I saw in my entire life inside Venezuela. So I'm always going to be grateful for that. And I already love this country. I don't know if this is going to be my home country for the rest of my life, because I still dream about returning to Venezuela eventually and becoming a leader there. But again, thanks to all of the things that I've been doing here, I have seen so many different opportunities, so many different things to do, and I want to keep it that way. And you know, as a migrant, especially coming from a place like Venezuela, I value the smallest things you can imagine. For example, having water supply in my in my pipe when I take a shower, for me that's huge, because that's something I basically lost when I was in Venezuela. We used to take showers with buckets, and that was it for me. Having the ability of buy groceries, whatever I want, and the quality I want, if I want the best having the ability to choose, that's something that I value so much, because I lost it when I was in Venezuela. Electricity, internet connection, I mean, those things that people here might take for granted because they have had it their whole life. Well, that's something I didn't have 3 years ago. So, you know, when I see my life in retrospective, I believe that, well, that was really my life. Was that a bad dream or what? Like, I cannot even believe that that was my life. And now when I see myself here, and you know, I live a modest life. I'm not like rich or anything. You know, even if I have so little here, it meant so much to me now that I'm here.
Mm. Jorge Galicia, he's been touring college campuses around the country with the Fund for American Studies. Thank you so much for your time, Jorge.
No, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. God bless you.
God bless you, Jorge. Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Today.